Good morning, Mr. Portali.
Good morning, judges. My name is Richard Portali, and I represent the appellant Coleridge Bell. We believe that the district court committed plain error. We believe that that error prejudiced a substantial right of our clients, of the appellant, and that it had a substantial impact on the trial, and it made a significant difference and a significant impact on the jury. Judge, we believe that the error was the district court's admission of testimony by Agent Bevington, and that Agent Bevington was allowed to identify Mr. Bell's voice on oral interceptions and oral recordings that were introduced to the jury. Well, Agent Bevington had never heard Mr. Bell's voice other than what he had heard on those recordings themselves. We believe this contradicts Federal Rule of Evidence 901B5 and the surrounding case law from all the different circuits, every case that was briefed by either party here and by rulings of this court. Federal Rule 901B5 requires, in order for that evidence to be heard by the jury, that the witness have heard the voice at an occasion under circumstances which connect the voice to the defendant. Each and every case briefed by either party, and each and every case that I could find, deals with the witness whose testimony is proposed having heard on another occasion, having had conversations with the speaker whose voice he plans to identify. I'm sorry, Judge.
Has any court rejected the use of inference from the circumstances where the witness is able to infer that the voice on the tape must belong to a particular person?
Judge, I haven't found any cases that either reject it or apply it. The only cases I've been able to find, including cases from this court in White.
It's a serious problem meeting the plain error standard.
Well, Judge, there isn't a case out there that deals with a situation where the person who's asked to identify and whose testimony is admitted hasn't heard that voice somewhere. The familiarity that's required under 901B5 and the cases that are chiefly relied upon by the government are Bush, where the court found that the witness was quite familiar with the voice of the speaker that was on the oral interceptions. Cruz-Rea, where there was a 15-second voice exemplar where the defendant admitted it was him. So that allowed that witness to have some familiarity, and that's what the court
said.
You
say some familiarity. The standard is minimal.
Minimal familiarity.
Familiarity, right.
And, Judge, it's a low standard.
So is that's what we're quarreling over, is what constitutes minimal familiarity?
I don't know that we're quarreling. We agree that minimal familiarity
is... You're quarreling with the government here.
Judge, minimal familiarity is a very low standard.
I thought this was how they found Bell in the first place, was they listened to the telephone calls. Nobody identified himself, and they identified him because of a niece who died.
Yes.
All right, so...
But the agent that testified, Bevington...
Was that Bevington? Who was it?
Bevington never found Bell.
All right.
And that's what's interesting about this case, is there was an Inspector O'Neill. He found Bell. He found Bell in New York. And he approached Bell, and he spoke to Bell, and he heard Bell's voice. And had his testimony been proffered to identify the voice in the recordings, I wouldn't have taken the train down to D.C. yesterday.
Do we know from the record who identified Bell in order to arrest him? I mean, from the phone calls.
Inspector O'Neill approached Bell, spoke to him.
No, I'm talking about the agent who listened to all these phone calls to determine that Bell was
Let's go find Bell, in other words. That was Agent Bevington.
All right,
whose background investigation sent O'Neill to New York to find Bell.
So Bevington's listening to all of these wiretapped phone calls.
Yes.
And he doesn't know who Bell is, but he listens to this voice for hours and finally puts enough together with his mentioning of his niece being deceased and going to the funeral and so forth.
Yes.
To identify that it is this Coleridge Bell.
And he makes a decision to go ahead and...
Right, and he's the same agent who testified at trial.
Correct.
Okay.
But he has never heard Bell's voice. And so then he's on the stand, and he's allowed to actually identify Bell's voice.
Remind me, what was the basis for his inference that it was Bell? He had been told that by others, right?
Yes, and I don't believe...
So your concern is that there's too tenuous a link now?
Absolutely.
O'Neill says, this is Bell, I know it, tells it to Bevington. Bevington listens to this and says, okay, I'm being told this is Bell. That's not minimal familiarity? There's something wrong with that?
Correct. Bevington has to himself had heard the voice, because he's not... There's two different sets of evidence.
Bevington heard a voice that he had been told was Bell, right?
Yes, correct. He never heard the voice himself. So we're not objecting to the admission of other circumstantial evidence to connect Bell to that voice. But it's the identification of Bevington, who never heard the voice. See, there's very little other evidence here by way... Surveillance, let's agree, is the hallmark of a narcotics investigation. There was no surveillance done whatsoever on Bell in order to tie Bell to this truck where the bug was placed. If we had had photographs or videos of Bell entering the truck just prior to the oral interception, then there would be at least some evidence that it's Bell that's in the truck that's on these recordings. But we don't have any of that. We don't have a GPS on Bell's vehicle traveling, let's say, from New York to D.C. around the time of the interceptions. We have nothing. And we don't have an individual testify.
We have the phone calls between Glover and someone else, right?
Between Glover and someone else.
All right, and they're trying to identify who this someone else is.
Yes.
And is this true? They hear variations, the FBI hears variations of Bell's first name as well as his birthday and age, and because Bell told Glover that his niece had just died in a major car accident, the FBI was able to find that niece's funeral program with Bell's name on it.
So they have a first name. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
All right, so is that how they identified him?
That's what led them to believe that it was Coolidge Bell.
All right.
They had a first name, a nickname, a funeral program, and a date of birth. And judges, I suggested that's very weak evidence to connect Coolidge Bell to the voice on that phone. And without that personal and very telling identification by Agent Bevington, the government could never have made their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
All right, how about his alias? They come up to him and he says, I'm Robert, whatever he said.
Indeed.
And I know you object to the admission of that.
I did, Judge. I'd prefer to spend more time on the other point.
But what I'm saying is, that's consciousness of guilt.
Yes, it is. But I don't think that, with the scant other evidence, is enough to sustain Bell's conviction beyond a reasonable doubt if you remove what we consider to be plain error in the violation of the Rule 901B5. So, you know, with that, judges, we're asking you for a reversal here, and we believe it's warranted. Now, turning to the safety valve, I think it's very clear from the transcript that, and Mr. Bell's objection at sentencing, that he had never heard of the safety valve, that his attorney had never...
That's not quite true. He said he had heard a lot of it from other incarcerated people. He hadn't heard of it from his lawyer.
From his attorney. And
it was in the pre-sentence report.
I'm sorry?
It was in the pre-sentence report, which I assume he signed that he had looked at it.
The record indicates that counsel never made any objections to the pre-sentence report at all. And the record also indicates that counsel never, ever contradicted or attempted to refute Mr. Bell's assertions that he had never spoken with his attorney about the safety valve.
But I'm saying the pre-sentence report itself says he would likely have been eligible safety valve relief in the pre-sentence report. So he had that notice.
Assuming that he admits that he heard it from other prisoners at the jail and not from his attorney, but the judge, he's entitled to an intelligent, reasonable, rational discussion with his attorney as to whether or not he wants to take advantage of that safety valve. And those two points...
Would he have taken advantage of it? Up to this point, you haven't claimed that he will.
That he would, and that he will.
He will?
It could save him 4 years. I believe that he will, were he given the opportunity to do it. And I don't believe that he was given a fair opportunity. And I believe that if Mr. Bell had sat down with his trial attorney and discussed the safety valve post-trial pre-sentence, even right up to the last minute. Had he known that it was going to save him 4 years, I'm quite sure that he would have done it.
What do you make of his counsel's statement at the sentencing hearing that in fact he had encouraged him to be more cooperative, but he had resisted that? What's that talking about?
Judge, I think it's very clear that he's relating that to conversations with the pre-sentence people, and that he wasn't as forthcoming as he should be with them, and the counsel had spoken to him about that and inspired him to be more...
3553 factors?
I'm sorry?
Are those the 3553 factors and not the safety valve? Is that what you're saying?
It's non-safety valve, sure. We're dealing with the 3553 deals with the government.
What do we do with the fact that if we sent it back for this hearing on the alleged Sixth Amendment violation, that you're talking about a conspiracy that ended at least 4 or 5 years ago, I guess.
Yes.
And he really couldn't give any substantial assistance. I mean, I know the test is a reasonable probability that he at least would have given as much as he knew, even if he knew nothing or even if he told everything he knew and the government said, we know that already, we've convicted everybody, all of this is just unnecessary and is of no use to us.
Well, Judge, it's hard for me at this point to tell you exactly how Mr. Bell could have helped, but if you know, assuming he knows what the government says that he knows, and you know, given what his role is in the conspiracy, if that were in fact true, I'm certain he would be able to meet the standard if he were given the opportunity to do it. But Judge, he really was never given that opportunity.
Okay. We'll give you a couple of minutes to reply.
Thank you.
Mr. McFadden, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Trevor McFadden for the United States, with me at council table is Anthony Scarpelli and Elizabeth Trozman. Your Honors, the district court did not err, let alone plainly err, by allowing the case agent, who had listened to thousands of hours of calls and truck recordings in this case, to identify, without objection, the speakers on those recordings. Moreover, because the record is clear that the defendant would not have taken advantage of the safety valve at sentencing, remand is unnecessary. I'd like to point out, first of all, this was not a mis-ID case. Appellant did not object when the special agent repeatedly identified the defendant and other speakers on the recordings as the speakers that they were. He never cross-examined the special agent about how well he knew the defendant, had he ever met the defendant, had he ever heard the defendant's voice anywhere else. He never introduced any evidence suggesting that these identifications were wrong. And when it came to closing arguments, trial counsel actually said, in some of these calls, you can assume that they were made by Mr. Bell. So this was not a mis-ID case. And the suggestion now that there was plain error when, as my opponent has just admitted to Judge Williams, there's no case on point suggesting that this was error at all, let alone plain error.
What was the defense?
I beg your pardon?
What was the defense? You've ruled out pretty much everything one could imagine.
As far as I can tell, Judge, it was an argument that, while there's evidence that Mr. Glover and these D.C. folks had these drugs because of the search warrant evidence, that there was no physical evidence tying appellant to any of these drugs, that the government's evidence was purely on phone calls, that you couldn't tell whether they're really talking about drugs or not. And of course, here there are really three separate ways that we've met the minimal familiarity requirement necessary. First of all, Special Agent Bevington testified that he listened to thousands of hours of recordings of a number of speakers and is able to go down and see all of these calls made from the same phone number, same speaker, talking to Linnell Glover. In those conversations, you hear Linnell referring to him as Cool, Cooley, Coolridge, so they've got the first name. Then they have his birth date through his statement, through the appellant's statements on these phone calls about his birthday was yesterday, I'm 43 years old. And then finally you have the the special agent's actually going to the funeral home, getting the program with his full name. So that's their investigative efforts.
So Bevington's not relying on O'Neill to make Bevington is not relying on anyone else for his identification of Bell?
Your Honor, he's relying on what he's heard and their investigative steps to confirm the identity of the individual, and they're actually able to find an appellant with a New York driver's license, full name, date of birth, matching what they've heard. The other thing that we haven't discussed is, of course, you have Richard Salter here, appellant's friend, who came in. He was the first witness to testify, and he said, yeah, I know Coolidge Bell. He actually makes an in-court identification of him and says,
what kind of identification?
An in-court identification, and says, we're longtime friends. We grew up together, I think. And he asked me several years ago to buy a phone in my name that he would use and that that he would reimburse me for the phone bills. And that was the phone number that the FBI kept hearing linked to this voice, Coolidge Bell. And so that's the other thing that certainly gets us over any sort of minimal familiarity or suggests that the judge plainly erred by allowing the special agent to link this man in the courtroom to these voices when the voice coming from that telephone has already been identified. Well, the voice hasn't been identified, but the phone number was identified with Coleridge Bell by the man who was paying the bills, his longtime friend. As I said, there were simply no attempts to discredit those identifications. I'd like to turn to the remand point. The government believes appellant has failed to show either of the two prongs necessary to justify a remand. Of course, this court requires that appellant give factual allegations, which, if true, would show a violation of the Sixth Amendment.
Well,
some of our cases seem to impose a considerably less demanding showing.
Your Honor, I think that the case law says that remand.
Look at Rashad, which formulates the test. It's considerably lower. It appears to be, so long as the claim isn't frivolous, there'll be a remand. I want to ask you about that. I mean, let's put aside the particular cases. Is it clear that remand is remand for a hearing, or is remand remand for the defendant to file such papers as he wants to before the district court, for the district court to rule on them and decide whether a hearing is warranted?
Judge Williams, I'm not sure that it would necessarily require a hearing, but what this court has required in Muhammad, which just came out last year, is factual allegations that would support both prongs of the ineffective assistance claim. And here, just looking at the second prong, the prejudice, appellant was very clear in the sentencing that he had no intention of being forthcoming, even though it was clearly to his benefit, even putting aside the safety valve.
But if he had not been told, if he was not aware of the safety valve option, doesn't that skew everything? I mean, how can one get to the point of saying there'd be no prejudice if he was not aware of his ability to take advantage of this?
Two ways, Your Honor. First of all, it was the same incentive. The incentive post-Booker to be forthcoming to a judge who has wide discretion to give a variance outside of the guidelines. And Judge Hogan indicated that in some ways he was searching for a reason to justify a potential variance, but appellant was completely unforthcoming. Judge Hogan said he had never seen a less informative pre-sentence report. And so with all of the reason in the world to be forthcoming there at the hearing, appellant says, I just want my attorney to file a notice of appeal. But secondly, even now, with a new attorney, appellant does not claim that he would have that he would have taken safety valve. And with due respect to my opponent, he cannot now come at oral arguments and say he believes that his client would take advantage of the safety valve. There is no such allegation in his brief. There's no affidavit suggesting he would have done so. And we cannot now hear at the final moments in oral arguments that he thinks that his client would take advantage of this. That's not enough. That doesn't satisfy even the minimal standards.
Now, the safety valve, if taken, is an automatic 2-point reduction, right?
That's correct.
The 3553A factors are a bit more nebulous, aren't they? I mean, to be certain, that they would be advantageous. But if you present somebody with the information like, if you pursue the safety valve option, this is what you're going to get, and it's going to be a 2-point reduction. That strikes me as being a bit different than the 3553A factors. You're saying you just cooperate and things are going to go better for you. I mean, it's a mathematical certainty on the safety
valve. That's not quite true, Your Honor. I mean, a judge has wide discretion regardless now. And post Booker, that's very clear. The judge.
But we know if he's going to exercise his discretion, what it will yield, right? A 2-point reduction, right?
That's certainly correct. I think the incentives, though, are the same. It's to your benefit, and this is what the trial counsel proffered to the court, that he had told his client it was likely to his benefit to be forthcoming.
Yeah, but the context of that, it was clearly not talking about the safety valve exception.
No, that's correct, Your Honor.
The pre-sentence report mentions the safety valve.
I believe it does. I don't think the...
Well, I've got it before me, and this is actually wrong. Had Mr. Bell pled guilty to the instant offense, he would likely have been eligible for the safety valve relief. He doesn't have to plead guilty, but at least that's in there about safety valve relief. What's your position about the fact that if he decided to be of substantial assistance, it would be stale?
Judge Henderson, I think they are certainly entitled, at any point, they're certainly entitled to that the safety valve consideration. That could certainly go into the weight that would be given to it. But even post, right up to sentencing, and if somebody has no information to offer, I mean, as a legal matter, as long as they're fully truthful, they are eligible for the safety valve. Here, the point is that appellant had the same general incentive to be forthcoming, did not then, and even now has not made a colorable claim that he would do so, that he would, debrief, and that's just not enough to justify a remand where this court requires something, a colorable and factual claims. If there are no further questions, the government respectfully requests that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
All right, thank you. Why don't you take a couple minutes? Can I ask you about the trial counsel's failure to object to you've got a Sixth Amendment violation on the safety valve.
Yes.
You just decided not to throw in the fact that he didn't object to the identification of Bell as deficient performance.
And combine that with the ineffective assistance of counsel and provide some synergy for the ineffective claim. Judge, I think that, you know, the government's position that is even clearer, that trial counsel was not even aware of a potential 901B violation. The trial counsel really provided no support for Mr. Bell whatsoever.
You're not raising that as a Sixth Amendment challenge.
Judge, I think that there has to be some synergy there, and there has to be, there has to be an analysis under the Sixth Amendment as to whether or not he received a fair trial. I also just briefly, Judge, I wanted to just address the mention in the PSR of the safety valve, and I think it's clear, and I think this goes to Judge Griffith's point, that Mr. Bell may have had some discussions about the safety valve with people at the jail, but that is a far cry from a meaningful discussion with his attorney about a mathematical formula that could provide him with, you know, up to 4 years less with that 2-point reduction. And I don't think it's very fair to now say that, well, his attorney never explained this to him, and so now his information is stale. We don't know that. And I think that the fair thing to do is to remand this case and to give him an opportunity to take advantage of it, and let's see what his information brings.
Government counsel raises the point that your opening brief and your reply brief don't include an assertion, which is an interesting question, it's just what a brief can assert, but anyway, certainly doesn't include any assertion that had I known what I now know, I would have done something different. Do you have an answer to that?
I didn't believe that it was that was the proper that was the proper format, and that's why I didn't include it. That was the proper route to take.
All right.
Or necessary. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Call the next case.